B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who served pimento cheese sandwiches at his wedding rehearsal dinner. True story, Charlie Nance.
If he is up there on the board on Friday and Saturday and he gets to play with the lead or play around the lead, I think that he's going to win the Masters. That's the key factor for him, is I think getting off to a great start, because as much as people say, oh, they're not intimidated by Tiger, they haven't seen Tiger at the top of the board. That's why they're not intimidated by Tiger. Trust me, they will be again if that happens.
Well, when you're right, you are right. And that was Taylor Zarzer of Sirius XM and PGA Tour Radio in a conversation from last week's show that we recorded the Monday before the Masters. I'm telling you, outside of the host, we've got some really smart golf people on this show. Hey, welcome back once again. We're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy. And normally, I would focus today on where do we go from here? And also one of my favorite tournaments on the PGA Tour, the RBC Heritage down in Hilton Head. And we will talk with Gary Soba, tournament director of the upcoming Wells Fargo Championship. By the way, probably, most likely, just about definitely the next time you'll see Tiger Woods on tour. But first, we have to talk about the historical, magical, mythical comeback story that is Tiger Woods, punctuated by him winning his fifth Masters and 15th overall professional major last Sunday. Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer will join us to put in his two cents, and I commend the piece he's written in the Global Golf Post this week to you. But we begin, as we always do, post-major, with golf historian Peter Kessler. I've been racking my brain for 2 days now trying to think of some example of a comeback that went to fruition like this. The only two that pop in my head in sports that I can think of is, of course, Hogan, who came back from getting hit by a bus in mid-20th century West Texas medicine and came back to win the U.S. Open, and one that's forgotten because of the tainted circumstances surrounding it, Lance Armstrong coming back from testicular cancer to win the Tour de France. It was just, even for the hardest and most cynical of us, Tiger's achievement on Sunday was incredible.
Oh, I say for sure it's the best one ever when you add up all the ingredients. You know, the long period of time where he didn't win one. And then, you know, he visited the center of hell, and he hung around there for quite a long time before he started to crawl his way out of there. I mean, and this was a different person in terms of his interpersonal dealings with the public than the Tiger who won majors previously. And, you know, when he did it in such Tiger-esque fashion, really, you know, starting with the second shot off the gravel path to 11 inside of Molinari's shot, that's when it was over for Molinari, even though I didn't obviously know he was going to hit it in the water. But Molinari, you know, hooked his iron to 10 and got away with it. He hit a short hook on 11 and got away with it because the ground was soft. That he knew when he hit it, that ball was in the water. I promise you 100%, if he took a lie detector test, he knew it was in the water. And then it ended up on the green. But he was still shook up because he knew it wasn't a good shot. So when Tiger hit that draw out of the trees off the gravel inside of Molinari, that's when everything that had started to happen to him came to its fruition. And, you know, everybody who makes that mistake on 12, they all do the same thing internally. They don't do anything different than recreational golfers who, at the last second, who are going to hit the middle of the green and they shoot 90, all of a sudden halfway down goes, oh, never mind, I'll go with the pin. I mean, that's what happened to Spieth when he made the 7 with the big lead. Certainly what happened to Poulter and Brooks and Molinari, I mean, and Finau. I mean, at the last second, it's, oh, no, I can do this. And, of course, Tiger knew from his conversations going back to Byron Nelson, who said in 1937 when he won his first Masters, which he thought was a major at the time he won it, he said he already knew that the only play you had on 12, if the pin wasn't on the left, which is a little bit more accessible, but still you can't be long there, was to always put it exactly over the bunkers with a drawn scoring club, not a cut shot, a drawn scoring club so that you're working away from the trouble and not towards it. And so what Nicklaus used to do is he really aimed over the left center of the bunker because his general shot shape moved a little bit left to right, so he allowed for that. But he didn't push like the other guys did. And that was just, you know, the final expression for Molinari of, okay, this is a little too hot in this kitchen for me, but I can't think of anything. Now, of course, you think of Jack in 86, but that was different because Jack was still particularly relevant in 86. You know, in 86, when Jack won the Masters, he completed a third Grand Slam that only began a few years earlier in 78. He wins the Open Championship in 78 at the Old Course for the second time, wins the U.S. Open and PGA in 80, so that's three legs of the Slam. He won tournaments between the age of 38 and 46, nine of them, of which four were majors, the Grand Slam for the third time, and he won them in the order in which they were created. Open, U.S. Open, PGA, Masters. Even he didn't know that when I told him that. He liked that one. He said, yeah, that's right. I won them in the order in which they were formed. So the difference there is that everybody was rooting for Jack. Even Seve lovers were rooting for Jack in 86. Nobody wasn't rooting for Jack. Not everybody was rooting for Tiger on this past weekend. You know, there's a lot of people who have issues with a number of things that he did in his personal life, who didn't like him anyway because of the way he was a cold-blooded assassin without saying hello, Mary, and hello, Frank, as he walked down the fairway. So he didn't have the universal love as to 100% that Jack had. So there was a different feeling, but this was about redemption and humility and clawing back and a dozen surgeries and all of the personal issues that unfortunately we had to become aware of, and the misguided press conference about his infidelities many years ago was totally unnecessary. It was poorly staged. It was a bad idea. And quite frankly, it wasn't really any of our business. And I didn't want to know, but this I thought was the greatest ever. That ironclad performance starting on the second shot on 11, right through the last hole, every shot was perfect. I mean, there were no more pushes. There was no more recoveries. There was just Tiger-esque, Nicklaus-esque, Jones-esque, Hogan-esque play down the stretch at the Masters.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. Thank you so much for bringing up 1986. As I've reflected back, there was a lot of symmetry between, in my opinion, what we saw on Sunday and what happened in 86. I think people have forgotten. They think that Jack just raced out and blew everyone away, and that was it in 86, and that was not the case. Jack went out and posted a 65 and posted a number, and then he needed some people to spit the bit coming in. Greg Norman had birdied four holes in a row and then fired that horrendous iron up right of the green and over the bunker on 18. And you mentioned Seve, and in fact, when Molinari rinsed that chip shot that hit the tree and fell in the water, that's the precise spot where Seve hit the poor iron approach into 15 on that same hole and rinsed it almost in the exact same spot. You had Brooks Koepka, who, in my opinion, and we'll get to this in a second, this is the only one that so far hasn't seemed to be fazed by the Tiger effect. He just missed a couple of putts on 17 and 18 coming down the stretch. But did you see the symmetry in 86 that I did?
Well, I think it was a little different because, you know, when Tiger stepped to the 15th tee, now he had already taken the lead at that point, and he added to it. But when Jack stepped on the 15th tee, he was actually four behind with four to play. And then he went eagle, birdie, birdie, and Seve made a pair of bogeys, and the whole lead disappeared. So Jack saw what was going on the leaderboard. Jack knew what he had to do. When Jack stood over his second shot on 15 with a four iron, he said to his son Jackie, his caddy, how far would a three go here, meaning an eagle three? And the greatest line Jack ever said to me about that iron in the 15 that year was that, oh, well, it was a four iron, and where the pin was, it didn't really matter if I was 10 feet to the right or 10 feet to the left of the hole. He said, so I was able to just fly it directly at the flag, knowing that I was going to have a fairly short eagle putt. You know, and I told that to a number of players about Jack saying, well, 10 feet either way with four iron. Every single guy said to me, including Gary Player and guys who won majors, they said, it's one thing to think you're going to be 10 feet off with like a pitching wedge, but a four iron from 220 yards downhill into the sun with you absolutely requiring a three to be back into the golf tournament. So there was a different dynamic at play. Jack had to go crazy at the end, where Tiger just had to play the back nine like you're supposed to play it when you win. You birdie 13, you birdie 15, you give yourself a chance on 16. I mean, the shots that Jack hit at 16 and Tiger hit at 16 in 86 and 2019 was the exact same shot. Jack had to hit a 5-iron at that time, 170 yards. And, of course, Tiger only hit an 8-iron, but it was the same shot. And they both had the same look after they hit it. It was an absolutely, yes, this is going where I intended it to. I'm not worried about where it's going to go. I know that I hit the shot I intended to. And immediately, Tiger started rooting for his ball to go in the hole. And Jack just looked like a bored spectator, kind of watching the events as his ball rolled toward the hole, as though it was completely expected by him. And, of course, it was.
Yeah, that's always the great story, is Jack hitting that shot and Jackie saying, be right, and Jack picking up the tee, and as he's picking up, saying, it is, and that was just all she wrote. I think my new favorite person as far as being prescient in the golf commentating world is David Duval. I point back to a quote from a year or so ago when all these young guys were saying how they wished they could play Tiger when he was at the top of his game and in charge of all of his faculties. And Duval looked straight at the camera and said, the hell you do. The Tiger effect is very real. It is still very real. And anyone who doesn't think it is only needs to see what happened. You know, Augusta National is a pressure cooker anyway. The second nine at Augusta National on Sunday may be the biggest pressure cooker in golf. I just think that eventually the hordes of people, and that's the only way to describe it, the hordes that follow Tiger in those situations, if you're not used to it, and Molinari was not used to it, especially in that circumstance, it wears on you, and eventually it gets to you. You brought up the hook tee shot on 10, you brought up the shot on 11, the shot on 12. His veneer, his stoic veneer, all of a sudden started to crack, and it's a very real thing.
Well, the stakes were just a little bit too high for Francesco, and I think it's a little unfair to get on his case too heavily, because you know you're not talking about somebody who you speak of in the same breath as Tiger. Francesco is in his mid-30s. We never heard a peep out of him really until the last 18 months, and he's been on an incredible run. He played beautifully at the Ryder Cup. He handled a not quite in form Tiger at Carnoustie. And he knew Tiger was not quite in form, and he knew he was kind of at home being, on the other side of the ocean. And so it was a different Tiger at Carnoustie, one that Molinari can handle and a circumstance that he could handle. But this was completely different. You know, this is a little bit like when, Jones and Jack were kind of modest in public, but they weren't modest at all in private. And Jones said to his friends many times, speaking specifically about major championships, that if you just keep throwing pars at them, eventually they'll all crack. And that's exactly what Tiger essentially did starting on 11. He didn't throw necessarily just pars at them, but he threw the things at them that you need to do if you're going to be the winner of the Masters. You need to shoot under par on the back nine. You need to birdie 13 and 15, and you need to pick up one more somewhere along the way for sure. And he did that. So basically, if you ask Tiger what he secretly thinks, it's, I knew if I did the kinds of things that I could do that allow you to win the Masters, that eventually they would all crack. And they did. You know, and Tiger said, gee, all of a sudden I had the lead on 12. I don't think there was any G to it. He saw Molinari's hooked iron on a 10. He saw the hooked iron on 11. He knew there were issues going on. He knew Molinari had hit a bad shot on 6, to just pick another example, and made a wondrous par. And the par on 10 was absolutely out of this universe. But Tiger knew that Molinari was right on the edge. And I don't think he was really worried about Finau, who he figured would take himself out of it, and that Tiger didn't need to do it for him. But Molinari knew what was going on. Tiger knew what was going on. And this is a different Tiger than we saw a year ago. This was the Tiger as to 80% who won the Tour Championship, and this was 90% Tiger who won the Masters this year.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. If you love golf, his website is a must visit, peterkessler.com. I was struck, having lived and worked in Augusta and been to that tournament many, many times, you get used to certain decorum, a certain amount of decorum that is just standard operating procedure at Augusta National. One thing I've never heard, never, is the outbreak of the spontaneous chanting of a man's name like we heard at the end of that Masters, and the outpouring, the overt outpouring of affection that was sustained like it was for Tiger. Do you think it's because golf is unique in that someone can become a part of our lives for much longer than any other sport? I mean, Tiger Woods has been at the top of mind in the world of golf for 25 years since he started winning his first U.S. Amateur. We have watched him go from the 21-year-old kid to all that he's been through, the triumphs, the tragedies, the self-inflicted demons and whatnot. And you've already brought up the redemption. Is part of it because we've known him for that long that he almost feels a part of us, that we feel so connected? Is that why there was that emotion, that spontaneous, that organic outpouring of emotion like that?
I think it's more than that, and I think it's more complicated, and I think it runs much deeper and is more complex than all of us realize as to what happened inside of us. You know, the great writer F. Scott Fitzgerald said there are no successful second acts in American life, meaning once you're gone, you're gone. And Tiger, of course, this last weekend proved that that's certainly not the case. And other people have certainly come back in their lives and been able to rebuild things. So that's part of it. But the other part of it that's even stronger is that it touched something inside of everybody in a kind of a universal way. You know, people thought about dads and kids and their introduction to golf, and they thought about their own lives, and they thought about people they knew who had come back from stuff, whether it be a dependency or reckless behavior or inappropriate behavior or a series of operations that make Tiger so much older at 43 than Jack was at 46. So this runs very deep. And this affected people in places where we're not usually taken, which is one of the reasons why this was so incredibly special, because it's so rare. And this has never been done before. Even the Hogan example, with no disrespect to him or his memory, he won a major in 48, had the accident in 49, but less than a year later, he was in a playoff for the LA Open. So comeback was immediate. So he won majors in 48, 50, 51, 52, and 53. So he won 6 majors after the accident, and he did it really quickly. And he was already at that time, you know, 40, and then, you know, just under 40, 40, and just over 40. So, you know, that was quite amazing. So on some level, he was still able to play his game. And Tommy Bolt and a lot of other guys, Sam Snead, swore to me that Hogan's swing was better after the accident because his lower body action was much less aggressive, and therefore the move through the hit was much more in sync, over which he had no choice. He didn't have the gear he'd had before. So he wasn't quite as long after, but he was much more even controlled than he had been in 48 when he was starting to peak, which had begun several years earlier when he returned from the war and briefly set the scoring record in 1945, right after Byron Nelson had set the scoring record, and then Nelson broke Hogan's scoring record. So, you know, Hogan got to play again really quickly, whether he was near death or not near death. We don't know exactly, but we know that it was serious, and we saw the car. and we saw him in the hospital, and we read the descriptions, and Tommy Bolt told me how he used to wrap his leg with bandages before he played, and how he had to put his legs in ice water after he played to just be able to reduce the pain and go ahead and do it the next day. So as Joe Namath said about his own professional football career, I never played a pain-free down as a pro. And after the accident, Hogan certainly never struck another shot that was completely absent of pain. So he dealt with what he had, but he didn't have the other myriad of issues. And it was 1 year before he won the U.S. Open again, not 11 years before. And while some of Tiger's things may have been self-inflicted and may have been self-destructive, they are what they were. People have issues. People are complicated. It's not easy living under that spotlight. You know, Winnie Palmer told me that it wasn't easy for Arnold to be Arnold, that men were after him, women were after him, and that, you know, how could any human being avoid the temptations on the road? So she said, I just didn't think about it. She said, I tried to put myself in Arnold's place. She said, it was just too overwhelming. Being Arnold was the most fantastic thing, but it was also overwhelming, and it created an opportunity for a certain lifestyle that Arnold didn't resist. But when he came home, he was a great husband. He didn't do things at home that would make Winnie uncomfortable. When he was at home, Winnie, you know, knew that Arnold was her guy and that she was Arnold's girl, and there was no question in her mind. But once he was on the road, she knew it was something even Arnold couldn't control. So that was different. And of course, the press, you know, shielded Arnold, and there were different times. You didn't have the media that you had today. So everything Tiger's done is under such an incredible glare of spotlight. But people say, oh, he's had a much harsher spotlight than Jones. That's why Jones was able to win. But that's not true at all, because Jones played in so few events that the pressure to win those very few events every year was extraordinary. He didn't play, you know, 16, 18 events over the course there. He played four times or five times. In 1930, he only played six times. He lost the first one, a pro event, by a shot to Horton Smith, then beat Horton by 13 shots in the next professional tournament, partially held at Augusta Country Club, where Jones later said he played his best golf of 1930, not in the major. So Jack felt in particular that the spotlight on Jones was even brighter than the one he had on him, and is about as bright as the one Tiger has on him today. And so can't discount the pressure of the Jones performances, because he had so few chances to make them happen, and yet he was able to do that. And so I believe at this point that, you know, nobody knows how Tiger feels. Nobody knows what's going on with his body except for Tiger, really. But we know that this is the best golf swing we've seen from Tiger since, oh, quite frankly, I think the Butch Harmon days. While he was extraordinarily successful under Hank, and he would have been extraordinarily successful under you and me,
yeah,
you know, he could win with any golf swing, but I always thought that was his best golf swing. Jack thought so, Arnold thought so, Gary thought so, Tiger thought so, and I think that's the swing he's making now. He's hitting that tiny little cut off the tee under pressure, and he's the best iron player almost literally in the history of the game, and if he's not, he's tied with, you know, less than five people. So, you know, with Tiger able to do the things with his clubs that approach greens the way he did this past week, it augurs particularly well for him to play, particularly at places he's comfortable at. But that's no guarantee. Just because you won somewhere before, you know, everything doesn't come flooding back and all of a sudden you're that person. Certainly it's a positive, but you have to discount it to a certain extent, because as Jack says about Tiger catching him, you still have to go do it.
Get you out of here on this. Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest, taking Dead Aim. You've known Tiger since he was a late teenager and an early 20s. You were there for the beginning of it all. You knew the fire that burned within him and what drove him back then. We don't know, as you said, what's going on in his head right now. We do know that he has said that one of the things that drove him was for his children to see who Tiger Woods was. With that being said, and what you knew from the past, do you feel that this victory is more likely to fuel him, or is there a chance of him taking the big exhale and just going, ah, see, I did it?
Both. You exhale because 11 years and 4,000 days have passed since your last major victory. So it's a big relief and it's a big accomplishment. And yes, his kids were able to see it. But now that they've seen it, you don't have to worry about that anymore. So now he can go ahead and focus on being Tiger Woods again. It's all gravy from here on in, but there's no way he's taking this lightly. The exhale lasts for 15 seconds. That's it. Then you have to go do the next thing. There's no regrouping. He exhaled, he did it, 11 years older, he came from behind on a Sunday, which he had never done before. It was 4,000 days after his previous victory. So there was an incredible amount of things that will allow you to exhale a breath and go, okay. But now you go, okay, that was really cool. I'm definitely doing this again. Are you kidding me? I'm in my 40s and I'm playing Tiger Woodsian kind of golf. Maybe not quite as good as I used to be, but sure scared the pants off of this group.
Always enjoy his perspective. That's golf historian Peter Kessler. And again, if you're a lover of golf, it's history and those who've made it, you must visit peterkessler.com. Tremendous website. And when we return, Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer takes dead aim at what he witnessed on the hallowed grounds of Augusta National last week, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ron Green Jr. has written a magnificent wrap-up piece from what he witnessed at the Masters last week in the Global Golf Post. I commend it to you. You need to check it out. And he joins us from Hilton Head, site of this week's RBC Heritage. Are you on the golf course right now? Is that birds I hear chirping?
I'm on the property. I'm not on the golf course. I'm sitting in a converted tennis court right now. But, yeah, the birds are all around. And I'm sure there's an alligator not far away.
Well, I just thought, talking to you was like talking to Jim Nance now. There's always going to be birds chirping in the background.
or that Masters theme song quietly playing in the background.
That's what you need, Ron. You need theme music. How many Masters tournaments have you covered? Not to put you on the spot.
I believe that would be 38.
Okay, so you've seen a lot. You have. You've seen some really, really great stuff. Ever anything that rivals this?
I think this one has its own sort of spot in history. I mean, there have been some special ones. Obviously, Jack in 86 is the one. That's sort of the emotional touchstone, I think, of the Masters.
Do you think was the emotion different or was it greater or worse this week? Worse is a bad term. Greater or less? Because I have never, I lived there for 5.5 years. I've been out there a bunch. I have never heard the organic, spontaneous eruption of cheering and chanting. That's as close to pandemonium as it comes at Augusta National.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I think it was similar, and I think it was different. Obviously, with Jack, it was the end, sort of. And you sort of had already written it off, like, okay, he's done it. We're finished. And then out of the blue at 46, he comes up with this performance, particularly that back nine on Sunday, and just wrote this unbelievable closing chapter when you thought the book had been closed. And now then Tiger was different in that 2 years ago we might have thought it was done and probably did think it was done. And then gradually he, had the surgery and thought maybe he comes back. And as you made the progression from month to month and through last year and, getting in contention, then having a chance in tour championship. So suddenly it made this real. The Nicklaus thing you never even thought was a possibility. This became a possibility, but, saying it was possible, then seeing him do it are two dramatically different things. And it was just, I think there's these last few days being here at Hilton Head, it's,
there's like an emotional and physical sort of letdown and release from all that, because I think there was so much put into it by so many people. And I think ultimately the the reality of it, seeing it happen, was maybe the impact may have been bigger than we imagined. I think it was you kind of wonder what it's going to be like if it happens. And now that it did, it just, you look at the front page of the New York Times on Monday morning, and there is five columns across the top. I mean, that tells you how big it is. And it just continues to resonate. I think I saw 32 million people watch part of the Masters broadcast on Sunday. And, it just touches people who may not be touched by golf, but it was a triumph to me beyond golf.
Is it because golf is unique in that the athletes are able to stay in the game longer than any other sport that we can have these extended emotional attachments? Because I got to thinking as I was watching the end of the tournament on Sunday, I've been watching Tiger Woods since he won his first U.S. amateur at Sawgrass. And that was, God, I don't want to say how many years ago, but that was 1994, 1995. And he's still a part of my life, my viewing life as a sports fan in 2019. You don't have that in any other sport. Is it because of that longevity or the potential longevity that we can have these emotional attachments like this?
Well, I think that certainly helps. I mean, if you can extend it that long, we kind of have it with Tom Brady, I imagine. In boxing, Muhammad Ali took it for a long, long time, for those of us old enough to remember him. But Tiger has been, he's just been this immense, enormous figure. I mean, this bigger than life in some ways, that, beyond, you had all the golf, then you had, all the human life parts of it and all that. And, not only has he done it for a long time and been out there for a long time, but here we are, he's age 43 and all, 20 plus years removed from when we first sort of got introduced to him, and he's winning another major championship. And we're not talking about just how great that is, but how many more he might win. And that way he's different than anybody has been.
Ron Green Jr. is our guest taking Dead Aim. I commend to you his piece this week in the Global Golf Post. It's really, really great work. And there's a couple of things I want to reference. First off, if 1997 Masters was Tiger the Magnificent and the 2008 U.S. Open was Tiger the Tenacious, this was Tiger the Unconquerable. I think almost more in spirit unconquerable and in determination unconquerable than in golf and athletic talent, because similar to Jack in 86, Tiger needed some help to get this one done. He needed some people to fall on their sword coming in, but he just, it was one of those things that you just saw from the second shot of 11 on. It was almost like watching Nicklaus, in that all he did was exactly what he had to do. He put the ball exactly where he had to be and waited for the others to fold and to die.
Well, I mean, Nicklaus talked about that a lot through the years, that part of the success of winning major championships was letting other people make the mistakes. And, Tiger made some mistakes early, and you're out there on the front nine, and he's not getting, he doesn't birdie the second hole, and then he drops a shot here, he picks up a shot there, and you're thinking, oh, he's, where's the mojo you need? It wasn't happening. And then suddenly, the whole tournament shifted on the 12th hole. There were a lot of tee shots hitting the water, but it shifted with Molinari's shot. When he hit it in the water and suddenly put double bogey on the card there, and you could see Tiger, he was already going to hit it right over the bunker, not toward the flag, but you couldn't help but notice that's where he's lined up. And talking to Joey LeCavi's caddy Sunday afternoon when it was over, I mean, Joey said from the 12th tee on, he hit every shot exactly like he wanted to. Even the shot at 18, he missed the green, but sort of a muddy ball. He was playing to a certain spot. He was just going to keep it away from the left side. He was fine to miss it short right and play for five from there, because he knew that was all he needed. But yeah, I mean, this, you see Koepka make mistakes, Finau, you see Schauffele rush up there. Suddenly there's Patrick Cantlay leading the Masters. You're like, well, how can this happen? We didn't even know he was in the field. He made the cut by a shot, basically. And then suddenly he had a shot, and you wonder if the moment becomes, suddenly they rush up on the moment, like, whoa, let me back off here a second. And then Tiger did all the things you have to do, and it's easy for us to sit here and say, well, you got a birdie 13, you got a birdie 15. Yeah, guys do that more than they don't do that, but you still have to do it. And, I mean, those are big holes. I mean, you're hitting a 200-yard shot over water to 15, knowing short or long is no bargain whatsoever, and you got the whole world watching, and the tournament hanging on your shoulders there. and he pulls it off. I mean, it's just, you know, it's funny. You saw the reaction with all the players waiting around to congratulate him, what it meant. And it's, I mean, it's just one of the coolest things you could ever see in golf. And, you know, the good part is, if we're lucky, it's not done.
Molinari, Finau, Koepka, Poulter, almost back-to-back-to-back-to-back, making the cardinal mistake. And it doesn't matter how many times it's pointed out to you, Spieth a couple of years ago with a shining example, Weisskopf years ago. It doesn't matter how many times you read what Byron Nelson said, what Ben Hogan said. What is it about that front right placement on Sunday that these players cannot resist? It must just be like, I've described it as a huge thing of cotton candy, and they're a kid. They just have to reach out for it, and it's deadly every single time, Ron.
Well, yeah, well, I think like Koepka said, he wasn't trying to hit it at the flag, but then he catches, and the wind was blowing a little bit, and suddenly you catch the wind, and you realize as slender as that green is, 2 yards changes everything, and suddenly you hit, and you roll back down the slope. There's no Freddie Couples being saving himself right there on that bank, and yeah, you know, that's why, you know, like I said, when Tiger stepped up there, the first thing I looked at was where his aim. You could see he was looking right at the middle of the green, and yeah, that's forevermore, you know, when Molinari, whoever steps up there on to that tee, that's what they're going to think about. And like, okay, if they get in that position again, don't do that here. Just, you don't make two here, you make three, and make sure you don't make five.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim, quoting your article again, your piece. Some players give us moments, some give us seasons. Tiger has given us a pursuit Shakespearean in scope, and I love that reference, by the way. Immense, immortal, and in places almost unimaginable. He is, if there's ever been a Shakespearean character in sports, it is Tiger Woods.
I mean, there's a heck of a movie could be made, you know, if you could do it just right. But
I don't know if you could do it. I just don't know if you could do it.
The Godfather in two or three parts.
Yes.
I mean, there's just so much of it. And then just to see the reaction. I mean, I heard the reaction. I went out to be at the 18th hole, and there were so many people. All I could do was listen to Tiger finish, not see him finish. But to see that reaction, and I mean, just sort of the unbridled joy. And the, you know, he's always been reserved. And I mean, those of us in Charlotte were surprised when he won Quail Hollow and turned around, flung his golf ball down the 18th fairway. That was pretty exuberant celebration by Tiger standards. And then this, I mean, just you could just tell. I mean, this was something he thought was gone, and here he had captured it again. And he's got his kids there and all that tie-in with his dad and all that. His mom's still there. That's good stuff.
You referenced it before, and I still find it stunning having witnessed, you know, Tiger Mach 1 when he pummeled his opponents like baby seals, and there was no one waiting around to shake his hand when it was over, nor was he waiting around to shake anyone's hand as he did with Brooks Koepka at the PGA last summer. To see the numbers of players, his peers, not just waiting for him, but Schauffele had tears in his eyes. I mean, these guys were genuinely overjoyed to share this moment with him, and conversely, he seemed overjoyed to share it with them as well.
Yeah, and, you know, guys like Schauffele talk about, you know, this. They grew up watching Tiger do this. And by the time they got on tour, he was basically gone. He was hurt and wasn't the same player and couldn't do those things. And suddenly, there they are again chasing, you know, one of the biggest prizes in the game. And suddenly they're chasing it with him. And if they're going to get beat by somebody, they'll take getting beat by him because they understand what it meant and they understood, you know, sort of the moment in time and the place in history for what this was. And, you know, it was cool to see that reaction. You know, as he's aged, I mean, he's a different guy. We've talked about that a lot. And he's been on all these President's Cup, Ryder Cup teams, whether it's a vice captain or as a player. And, you know, now he's going to be the playing captain of the President's Cup team down in Australia this fall. You know, I think there's a whole different level, layer there to who Tiger is, and not just to himself, but to his competitors. I mean, he still can get cold-blooded, and he locked in there Sunday afternoon, and it was, you know, he had that sort of stare about him, and nothing was going to get in his way. But I think, yeah, I think he loves having the relationship with the players he has now.
Would you find it more surprising if he never had another great moment, or that he had more great moments?
I don't think he's done. I think he's still got something left. I don't know. I mean, if he wins 16 or 17, I think if he tied Nicklaus, that would be something that would be up there on that sort of, you know, the, on the mantelpiece up there with the best moments of them all. But I think this one's right up there. I think this is, you know, it may ultimately turn out this is his 86 Masters. You know, I will never see him, anybody maybe play a tournament like he played the 2000 U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. But this one, you know, it's going to be hard to top it unless he gets to Jack's record. And that's still a big mountain to climb there.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. Fun question here for you. You already mentioned Joe LaCava. Bigger deal, Tiger with a 22-year span between first and most recent Masters wins, or Joe LaCava, 27 years between Masters wins with Freddie and now Tiger?
Tiger. Freddie was, I mean, Joey would tell you, he was just carrying the bag, staying out of the way. But he was nice to, you know, he was fun talking about it Sunday afternoon, talking about those things and, you know, comparing shots in certain places, things like that. So, that's a pretty good bookend for Joey.
GlobalGolfPost.com is the website to check out Ron's piece, which, by the way, Tiger's people have requested a poster size copy to frame. How cool is that? That, of course, the great Ron Green Jr. And up next, time to look ahead a couple of weeks to perhaps the next time Tiger roars on tour right here in the Queen City. Gary Soba, tournament director, takes dead aim at his upcoming Wells Fargo Championship. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. April 29th will be here before you know it, and that, of course, is the start of one of the finest tournaments on the PGA Tour, and it's ours, the Wells Fargo Championship at Quail Hollow Club. And last week, I had the chance to catch up with tournament director Gary Soba. This is my favorite question to ask you at various times of the year. Where are we now on a lot of different levels? Let's start with where are we now in terms of the course itself? It's been wetter than a baby's diaper in Charlotte, and Wells is in Charlotte at Quail Hollow Club. I was out there a couple of weeks ago. I was blown away by the condition of the golf course.
I tell you what, I think the golf course may be in the best condition ever. The tour chief agronomist, Chuck Green, came in here, and he didn't stay long. He said, Gary, the golf course is awesome. The greens are the best they've ever been. So I think the patrons will find that the golf course is in phenomenal condition.
Where are we in terms of infrastructure? This is always fascinating to me. We were out there for a media day, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks ago now, and construction was well underway on grandstands and other things around Quail Hollow. How long does it take from start to finish for them to build everything up that has to be built?
Well, that's a good question. We typically start a little more than 2 months out with the major build projects. I do think that people are going to see we've invested heavily in infrastructure this year. We have all new tents. You come out and look at the tents, the people in the marquees, the chalets, the private clubs, those are all new tents. We've added a new grandstands on number 2 and 10 for the general public. We've added a military outpost. First time we'll ever have had a military outpost, and that will be on 14 Gree, 15 T, and you're going to look across the water and see gables and the circular medallion logos of each of the services. And so we've tried to do a lot in terms of expanding the infrastructure.
Last year was your first year in this world. what was the most unexpected aspect of the job that you came across?
Well, I was talking to one of our ambassadors on 17 Green while play was going on, and unfortunately, the individual had a seizure. And right in front of me, I mean, I'm 3 feet away, and I tell you, our medics were there within 30 seconds. But it was scary. It was extremely scary. But I tell you, our ambassadors, medics, so forth, they were so attentive. And this was right in the peak of a Friday. There were thousands of people surrounding 17 Green. So Dillard Pruitt, I said, Dillard, what do you do? He's our rules official. I said, what do you do under those circumstances? He said, any questions, he goes, go pull the flag. No one will ever hit a golf shot if they have nothing to aim at. I thought that was interesting. I hope I never have to use it, and I hope we don't have, that was his second year growing. He's fine. Of course, he's fine. He's from Raleigh, but that was pretty scary.
Well, and of course, Gary, you're running a golf tournament. The phrase, is there a doctor in the house? You probably wouldn't be able to swing a dead cat without finding 30 of them right there by
you. We had one within 6 feet. Honest to goodness. We truly did. He was there immediately.
Gary Sobas, the tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. We talked after Wells last year about, you know, you wait 2 or 3 weeks, and then you sit down with Mac and with Johnny, and you do sort of a post-mortem on where were we this year, what could we do that was better, where was something that we tried, but, you know, maybe it just didn't work out. On almost any level last year, an unqualified success and a renewed energy, I felt, definitely, at the Wells Fargo Championship. When you sat down after that post-mortem, what was something that the three of you came to a consensus to and said, you know what, we can do this better?
Well, that's a really good question. I will tell you, they were extremely pleased, you know, from all aspects. Unbelievable weather, tremendous financials, you know, unbelievable support and our ability to support local charities. So they felt really, really good. I that following week, went to the Players' Championship and sat down on 17 and 18 down there, and I realized how they use video boards. So one of the things I brought back and what we're going to do is we're going to add a 1,000-square-foot video board behind 14 green. The video board will face 16 and 17.
Oh, great.
And I think the people there will be an unbelievable vantage point because, you know, you can see 16, 17, 14, but now you also know what's going around the golf course. So doing that, you know, and doing things like such as a new craft beer area that's really, really popular. We're enhancing our kids' village, which I think will be really popular, doing things with First Tee, and then we've added an autograph alley for children as well right around the putting green. So trying to tweak it. We added a concert last year. We've done some other things that I think our patrons will feel really good. Our Green Mile Club members, we're adding I call it Son of Green Mile on the front side on 7 and 8. So just two or three things that'll be better. And one final thing, on Pro-Am Day on Wednesday, we're going to have music on the range. So that's different.
Wow, look at you. You know, when I was there for that media day a few weeks ago, the next day you were flying down to Austin, and you already mentioned that you picked something up from the TPC. That was one of the things I was curious about. As you go around to the different tournaments, and I know you go to several throughout the year, what are some other things that you've picked up along the way? Like, you know, when you're down at the match play, which is a big event, it's a WGC event, you go, you know what, we could do that here, and maybe we could do that better here.
Yeah, you always kind of look at best practices, and what I have found is that my predecessors, they did such a good job. We are best in class in so many areas. You know, you saw the caddies, 65% of them said we were the best. But you look at little things. They look at player services. You look at family dining. You know, primarily I'm there to talk to players and recruit players. But you look how they build their facilities. You look at their merch tent. You look at their interactive zone. How do they utilize kids? You look at, you know, the adult areas. So you kind of look at everything. And you glean maybe 1, 2, 3 things from almost every tournament. You know, we will be always, you know, probably on the side of more Augusta, like fewer, bigger, better. Want it to be extremely classy, you know, so you go to certain events and it's more Barnum Bailey. Don't ever want that here. And I don't think our fan base wants that here. But, you know, you try to, you know, you look at what's going on in Phoenix. How do we draw more fans to help, you know, more people with charity, but still have that really ultimate, you know, Charlotte class feel?
Gary Sobas, the tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship, our guest taking Dead Aim. We referenced the recruiting visit. The paradigm, maybe it's just for this year. I want to feel like it is, but maybe not. The paradigm going forward as far as players committing to tournaments has completely changed as opposed to years past when players would literally commit almost to their entire schedule at the beginning of the year or even 3 months out from a tournament. But with the way they're trying to navigate the new schedule, it almost seems as every player is sort of taking baby steps each week with, well, I don't want to commit here. And is it frustrating to you, or is it just something, for lack of a better term, and I not to use a cliche, but par for the course?
Very, very good question. Frustrating is probably the wrong word. Our field's going to be stellar. I can tell you my commitment list versus who has told me they're coming is extremely different. Yes, I would love to be able to put them on the commitment list and then publicly be able to utilize them in promotions. But, I mean, we're going to have a heavyweight field. We're going to have a tremendous field. But to your point, not many players have committed to events post-Masters. When I say that, that's the top 20, 25 players in the world. They don't want to commit then withdraw because they would feel bad. All of a sudden, people are counting on them, then they withdraw. So there is a wait-and-see approach. I talked to Gary Woodland yesterday in Augusta, and he talked about that. I said, Gary, you're coming? Yes, I'm going to come, but I just haven't committed to anything post-Masters. So it is different. The Florida schedule was significantly different as the tour compresses the schedule to end in August. It is more a challenge on their ability to, okay, how am I going to feel? What can I commit to? How do I not overschedule so I'm fresh and prepared in every tournament? And then I've got to be ready for the majors, players, you know, Augusta, and then PGA, Open, and then FedEx. So it is different.
Now, to give people an idea about where you are on the schedule, and it is a magnificent place on the schedule, Wells Fargo Championship is 3 weeks after Augusta or 3 weeks after Hilton Head and 2 weeks before the PGA?
It is 3 weeks post-Masters, 2 weeks pre-PGA. That is correct.
Okay, so for people who don't know how golfers like to do things, after a major, if they're not going to Hilton Head to decompress, they're going somewhere else to decompress for a week. And then they may come back the week after that, but they definitely want to get their game starting to get sharp heading towards the next major championship. And if you're going to a PGA championship, I don't know, let's get our game sharp at a place that has held a PGA championship. So I have, like you, I have every faith in the world that we, as great as the field was last year, it would not surprise me if we look at the list on the Friday before and go, wow, this is some kind of commitment list.
Well, I certainly hope so. When the schedule came out, and we were locked into the first week of May, we think that's the perfect week for us for a lot of reasons, specifically the course being overseeded in fantastic shape. But we felt really good about it, and we feel really good about it. So 3 weeks post-Masters, 2 weeks pre-PGA, I think is near perfection here.
Gary, I would be remiss if I didn't look ahead a little bit. 2021 is going to be here before you know it, and the President's Cup will be contested at Quail Hollow Club. When we contested the PGA, the Wells Fargo Championship moved for a year. It's a quick turnaround from May to September, I guess, or late August or September for the President's Cup. Is there a thought to moving it again, or are we going to try the quick turnaround?
No, we will be out of the market in 21.
Okay.
So just like in 17, we will be in another market in the during the 2021 year.
Has there been any thought, and I'm sure there has been, and I know I'm going to get the no comment, polite answer from you, on a different routing of the course for the President's Cup so that more matches get to play the green mile, the heart of the golf course, 16, 17, and 18?
I don't think it's public yet, but I do believe you will see a different routing of the golf course, so the green mile is in play. My understanding, a normal match play round is 16-point-some-odd, 16-point, I'm going to say 7-5, something like that. The normal match lasts that many holes. So, you know, you look at that and you figure you want the current green mile, the 16, 17, 18 to be in play. So I think there will be some thought perhaps to doing some rerouting for the President's Cup.
All right, get you out of here on this. Gary Sobas, the tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's start talking about tickets. Let's start talking about where they can get them. How does one get into the Wells Fargo Championship this year?
It's easy. There's really three options. You can stop by Golf Galaxy, you can stop by Dick's Sporting Goods, or you can go online to wellsfargochampionship.com.
Will there be discounts for military again this year?
Yes, there will be. So, and children 12 and under are admitted free.
I can't wait. In my opinion, the Wells Fargo Championship is the Charlotte area's finest annual moment. We really shine for the world to see. That's Tournament Director Gary Soba. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer and golf historian Peter Kessler. Be sure to visit his website, peterkessler.com, for their time and insight regarding last week's historic Masters. A reminder, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Also, our terrestrial radio times have changed on Fox Sports Radio Charlotte, 94.7 FM and 1660 AM. You can now hear us twice a weekend, Saturday mornings from 7 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to noon. Hey, weather-wise, seems all the bad stuff is behind us, and there's plenty of great weather in the Queen City this weekend for you to find a way to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.